All right, if you take out your message outline for today, we have been working through the Old Testament one book at a time, an overview, and today we come to the book of 2 Chronicles. Okay, God, I read 2 Chronicles again this week, and if I get this book and some of the books that we've studied the last few weeks, if I've gotten one thing out of it, it's this. That I need to make the center of my life you. And that if I make anything else the center of my life, I'm going to make a mess of things. I will make a mess of things in me, and I will make a mess in the lives of the people that I claim to love around me. Have I got that right so far? And I think he would say yes, as some of you just said yes. And then towards that end, what I need to be willing to do is to face the worst part about me. I need to have some humility and to be willing to hear hard things from people where they see things in my life that need changing, and then to be open to that instead of being defensive. Am I hearing you correctly on that one? He would say yes. Okay, well, God, so far so good, I think. And when life is going pretty well, I think I'm generally thinking along those lines. But I can tell you, and you know this, that when something comes out of left field and throws me a gigantic curveball, I lose perspective pretty quickly. For example, last week I talked to a friend of mine I went to seminary with, and he shared with me that his daughter recently had been raped. Now, if I'm hearing what you're saying to me in these books, that what my friend and his daughter should do, in theory, is in spite of how bad situation is, and that's a horrible situation, a terrible situation, but in spite of how terrible that is, somewhere down at the center of both my friend's heart and his daughter's heart, even in spite of this, there needs to be a place of coming again to you, to where you are the center of their heart, and they're thinking more of how can I relate to God, love him, and respond well to him and to the people in my life on a daily basis more than the old priority, which is our priority, how can I get life to work well, or how can I get God to make my life work the way I want to? That's what you're saying as I understand these last few books. Now, God, I can't imagine telling my friend that over the phone. In fact, the idea of telling him that makes me want to scream. What I'd rather say to him is, you know, I know that your daughter called out to God for help and no help seemed to come. And my question to you is, why? Why didn't you do something to prevent that? You could have given the guy a flat tire on his way there. You could have had a lightning bolt strike him dead. Why didn't you do something? And I think God would say to me, Seth, you need to know that my heart broke and breaks for your friend and for his daughter. Well, that's really not the answer I was looking for. Seth, it's an important answer. It's an important answer to ponder, and all you should do really to grasp something of the significance of that is remember what happened at the cross. When something far worse than what happened to that daughter happened to my son. And I let that occur. I did not intervene. Okay. I still don't understand why you wouldn't do something. I think God would say to me, I have. And I am. And I will. Okay. You have my head spinning. But I have to say, it seems like I'm now over my pay grade and sort of lost as to what you're driving at. In your handout and on the screen, if God were to fix all you see that is wrong and painful without first destroying evil that lies within all of us, no one would get to heaven. No one would want to. In other words, what I'm concerned about is why doesn't God do something about the difficult situations that go on in the world? And although those are concerns to him and they break his heart, they're a bigger fish to fry. And he is trying to use all of the worst of events, whether they come from a human being, like what happened with my friend's daughter, or it comes through things like a hurricane last month up in the Northeast, God is using all of those things in His purpose to try to eradicate evil that lies within each one of us. Again, in your handout. In His plan, He must do whatever is necessary to destroy the evil within us, where the desire for the good life is greater than our desire for Him. He must replace that idolatrous desire with the holy desire to know Him at any cost. This is something of what He's doing in your life, in my life, on a day-by-day basis. This is the battle that rages down in the human heart. My human heart wants to make life work how I want to, how I think it should, and to make it easier, and God is obligated to do that. I want to build the center of my life around making my life better and the life of the people I love. And God said, that's a bad center. You're going to make a mess of things. That has got to change. That's what God calls evil. That's tough to hear because I don't want to believe that I am evil or something like that does lurk inside of me. He's going to do this at any cost, even in the midst of our worst pain. Only then, he would say, Seth, can your friend and his daughter experience eternal joy in heaven someday. There's something far greater to this story than what you think of. In your handout. For reasons we have no capacity to understand, he must allow suffering that serves no visible purpose. Sometimes things happen in your life and you are just as confused as can be. My friend is in that. His daughter is in that. And as an observer halfway across the country, I'm confused as well. This is clearly beyond our ability to understand, but it is true. Why is it true? When I think of evil, I normally think of natural evil. Hurricane on the East Coast, the eastern banks of North Carolina. A tsunami in Asia. Mudslides in Southern California, earthquake. God would say to me, Seth, someday there's going to come a day when none of those will exist. But until that time, I am not just trying to do something about natural evil. In fact, I allow it and I use it. What I am trying to do is to do something about moral evil that lies within every human heart. If people are allowed to live their life with their center, I just want my life to work, I want it to go easier than it is, they will loosen hell upon themselves and upon the people around them. It's just a matter of time. That has got to be stopped. But people don't want to see it. They don't want to admit it. It makes so much sense to them to make that their center. I am going to do something about that, which really comes back to the title of the message. If God were to say to us the message of 2 Chronicles, it's no defeat can defeat God's plan. No matter how bad a situation you're in, no matter how much your back is up against the wall, God is going to use those things redemptively in our life to change us. Okay, God, I see. This is way more complex than my puny brain can wrap itself around. And it's much harder to do than I ever imagined. I'm kind of spinning here. Last thing, no matter how confusing your suffering, live in the mystery of God's love. Do not live with the priority or the center of making your life in this world as good as you can make it. You will suffer, but you will be given what you need to enter strongly and wisely with supernatural love into every circumstance you face. That is what God is trying to do in my life. No matter how difficult a situation I may be in, the situation is not ultimately the thing he's trying to change. It's me. And he's trying to get me to trust him enough to center my life around him, and then today, to enter into my world and my relationships and my responsibilities with the determination to enter them strongly and wisely to make a difference for him. That is how he defines real life. Again, in your handout. Doing so will be your joy, your hope, and your deepest fulfillment now, as you look forward to a world where every bit of suffering will be over. These are as different of ways of approaching and living life as you could do. And our problem is, our default, our autopilot is the former. And God is working day by day to change that. Now, as we end this part of the message, my response to say, is that what I should have gotten out of 2 Chronicles when I read that this week? And the answer is yes. Now, to understand the book of 2 Chronicles, a little historical perspective. The book of 2 Chronicles is written, covers a historical period of almost 400 years. The beginning of the book starts with Solomon. The end of the book is the destruction of the nation, taken off into captivity, most of them, for 70 years, and a small little remnant, a small percentage of people come back to Jerusalem, and the city they come back to, that their grandparents and their parents had talked about, was a rubble, a field of stones. Not one building standing. If you saw the pictures of the tsunami in Japan several months ago, in the worst possible places, that was something of what these people came back to when they came back to Jerusalem. No temple, no shops, no homes. Babylonians did not leave one building standing, no wood, no wooden structures, no stone upon stone, as the writers describe. Now, what would you be tempted to do if you came back to that? We're the smallest nation. We don't have a navy. We don't have an army. Nobody has a job. We're all camping. And our job is to rebuild the city and rebuild a temple, and we're just living on a shoestring. I would be tempted to despair. We came back from Babylon to this. This is why the writer writes 2 Chronicles. He says, I want you to remember some things from your history that will serve you well as you try to live in an utterly awful situation here in Jerusalem, starting all over as a nation. Now, the first part of the book has to do with the temple. And what God does in the first 9 chapters is remind the people, 400 years later, there was a time in your history, 400 years before, when Solomon built this temple. And when he did, and the center of the people and of the individuals and the king was centered on me, there were great things that happened. I want my people 400 years later to remember that. You don't need a wall. You don't need a temple now. You don't need houses now. The priority one is to center your life around me. And he gives them 9 chapters in the start of this book about the glory days of building the temple and dedicating the temple. And we pick up the story in chapter 7. When Solomon finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices. Imagine that. They dedicate the temple, and all of a sudden, you know, we might call it a bolt of lightning. Fire comes down on that huge outdoor altar and consumes everything. The glory of the Lord filled the temple. The priests could not enter the temple of the Lord because the glory of the Lord filled it. When all the Israelites saw the fire coming down and the glory of the Lord above the temple, they knelt on the pavement with their faces to the ground. It's a picture of centered, being centered. They got the message. And they worshiped. And they gave thanks to the Lord, saying, He is good and His love endures forever. Now, why 400 years after this would the writer put back in front of the people this very vivid story? I think what he's wanting to do is to give them a vision. This is something of what I want to do in my people today. It seems to you like you're a million miles from that. How are we ever going to get there? Trust me. Put me at the center of your life just like Solomon and the people did 400 years before and watch what I can do. The whole purpose of the glory of the Lord falling down at that moment that the writer describes 400 years afterwards was this can happen again. But you need to center your life on me. I think he was also doing something else. Think about these people who are camping amongst rubble. And they hear a story about the glory and wonder of the temple when it was dedicated. They would be tempted to despair. But I think what God was trying to do is to whet their appetite, to stir a satisfaction in them that no human being or no human accomplishment could do in the human heart, other than if God was the center of these people's lives. In verse 14, he says, If my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land." Now, that was an important word in Solomon's time at the height of the nation. But 400 years later, the Chronicle highlights those same words and says, in some ways, they may be more important to you now. When your life seems to be a rubble, where you've made a mess of things and hell is loosed on earth in your family or in your personal life. What he says here is the way out of this is to come back to center yourself on God, to humble yourself, to pray, to seek my face, and turn from this way of trying to make life work how you want to. That keeps making a mess of things. I will hear from heaven, will forgive their sin, and heal their land. First nine chapters have to do with the temple. It's a picture of centering their life around God. The last 27 chapters have to do with the kings of Judah. Now, this covers a period of about 400 years. Solomon and 19 other kings of Judah. He highlights Solomon. And what's interesting about this in this particular book is where in the book of Kings, the writer described many of Solomon's failings. In this book, he only describes one. It's not that he didn't have a bunch. But again, think about the people who are going to be reading this 400 years later. He highlights one failure. He says, "I want you to remember how Solomon made an alliance that he never should have made. He panicked. He tried to make his life better. He thought if I have a military alliance, then somehow that will make my life better. And he made a double mistake by marrying a princess of Egypt. Went into an alliance with Egypt because he was trusting what Egypt could do. And he married a foreign woman that God had told the kings, do not do this. Trouble is going to come and it's going to be a boatload of trouble." In other words, what he did was, he thought about his life, he thought about his responsibilities, and he panicked. And he said, rather than really entrust the center of my heart to God, I'm going to take control. Something I'm going to do. And it seemed for a short time like that was a swell idea. Now, in his heart, he knew that this really wasn't the right thing to do, but he justifies it. Look at chapter 8. Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up from the city of David to the palace he had built for her. For he said, "My wife must not live in the palace of David, king of Israel, because the places the ark of the Lord has entered are holy." Now, he knew he shouldn't have married this woman. No question about that. But in order to justify it to himself, he said, well, rather than bring her into my palace, the king's palace, where I know that's a no-no, I'm going to build a separate palace, sort of away from things, and I'll put her up there in her home there. Over time, what he did was he married other women, and he built their palaces closer and closer to Jerusalem until finally there were foreign idols in even the temple. Verse Kings 11, this had a terrible effect upon Solomon and the nation. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. He did, originally, what made sense to him. Going to make things more secure around here. Got it locked down. Egypt, a strong power. But what he did, that decision, and the decision to marry the princess of Egypt, ended up being the undoing of his whole kingdom. It took a while for that to happen. Didn't happen immediately, as these things happen. But eventually, hell on earth was loosed. It took some years before we saw it upon the nation when they split. In your handout. If even in small ways you live to fix your life as priority, to arrange for your own pleasure in ways that violate holiness, your love for a better life now will eventually corrupt your love for him. It will remove you from your center. Just a matter of time. Now, the second thing that's striking about the kings here in this book is the northern kingdom. Not one king is mentioned of the northern kingdom. None mentioned. All that are mentioned are five kings from the southern kingdom. And we're going to take the rest of our time here to discuss five of these. First is Asa. Asa came into power, and he followed a wicked king. The nation had gone down, down, down. And somehow he thought, we've got to bring reform, but he was scared to do it. A hesitant leader. 2 Chronicles 15, 6, we pick up the story. This is, verse 6 is world news. One nation was being crushed by another, and one city by another, because God was troubling them with every kind of distress. From a human point of view, it looked like just, you know, another era of wartime and a mess. But God is using human evil as a way of trying to open up people to the reality to center their life on Him. And it takes suffering to do it. We will not listen to Him very much without suffering. Now, verse 7. He says to the timid king, Asa, but as for you, be strong, do not give up, for your work will be rewarded. Even though it seems like a daunting task, how are you going to get all these people, the religious leaders, the government leaders, to get on board with all these reforms you want to do? How are you going to do it? Take courage. Stand up. Be strong. Do not give up. It says, for your work will not be rewarded. Will not go unrewarded. There's coming a time. I have no guarantees when that work was rewarded. But there is coming a time that says, because I do know that my work will be rewarded, whatever I'm doing for the Lord, motivated for the Lord, whether in my marriage or with my kids or my church or my small group or at work, because that's true, I can be strong and I can have the perseverance to not give up. And so what he did was he reestablished the covenant with all the people, and the people responded. All the leaders responded. He took courage and it made a difference. Now, think about the people hundreds of years later, that little remnant. What do you think verse 7 would mean to those folks there? In the midst of just devastation there in the land. As for you, be strong. Do not give up, for your work will be rewarded. Well, no, I keep saying that wrong. Your work will be rewarded. Your work will be rewarded. I can tell you, in my own personal life, there have been countless times where I stand on that promise. And I've done that as a husband. I've done that as a father. I've done that as a pastor in our church. And in my personal life. There are lots of times where I think, you know, God, I just don't know if I have what it takes to do anything right. It seems like I screw these things up so easily. It seems like it's so hard to meet people's expectations. I never do seem to get this right. Sometimes life is just discouraging. If you're a guy, so that's just part of life. That's part of our battle here until we get to heaven. It is a battle. There are times just to buck up and be a man, be strong, take courage, and whatever's in front of me today, embrace it and enter into it. Because whether I'm guaranteed of any reward now or what I'm going to see now, eventually I know reward is coming. And whenever that day comes, I'll be glad I kept moving now. I'll bet that was a good word of those folks camped out on that rubble. Now later in his old age, the next chapter, he says, one of the prophets came and says, because you relied on the king of Aram and not on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Aram has escaped from your hand. Now, he had made a pact with the king of Aram. Again, he thought it made sense to him. It's going to strengthen the nation. We've got another army that's going to help us, kind of like NATO. It made sense to him. But the prophet says, you screwed that thing up. You screwed it up badly. Well, you should have just trusted God. And the reason is, you made a pact with the devil, a deal with the devil. You thought the king of Aram is going to be our friend. For a short time he was. But there came a time when the king of Aram had a turn of heart and became an enemy. And what the prophet says is, from God's point of view, he was going to give the king of Aram into your hands. But because of what you did, you screwed that whole thing up. Verse 8. Were not the Cushites, which is Ethiopians, and the Libyans a mighty army with great numbers of chariots and horsemen? Yet when you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. Don't you remember? You've got some history here. You did it right. Ethiopians came. Libyans came. You trusted God, and God gave them into your hand. No problem. Why did you jump at this? Verse 9. The prophet says to him, "For the eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. You have done a foolish thing. From now on, you will be at war." Now, imagine what the remnant, hundreds of years later, thought about this verse. The eyes of the Lord run throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. Center your life on God. You're in rubble. You're camping. Center your life on God. Build the temple. Center your life on him. Then we come to Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat was invaded by three armies. They were up against the proverbial wall, had no idea what they were going to do. And the king calls for a national fast and a day of prayer. And so they go to prayer, they go to fasting, and one of the prophets comes to the king and says, "From God, you will not have to fight this battle. Take up your positions. Stand firm and see the deliverance the Lord will give you, O Judah and Jerusalem. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Go out to face them tomorrow, and the Lord will be with you." Now, why did the chronicler tell this story again to the remnant? These folks, if anybody felt like their back was up against the wall, was these guys. Everybody around them was stronger than them, and here Jehoshaphat is being invaded by three different nations. Instead of making pacts and treaties with people he shouldn't, he takes the whole nation, centers them on God, and says, "We are up against the wall. Only God can deliver us." Verse 22. The army began to sing and praise. The Lord set ambushes against the men of Ammon, that's one nation, Moab, the second one, and Mount Seir, the third nation. The men of Ammon and Moab rose up against the men from Mount Seir to destroy and annihilate them. So the army goes out there to fight. There's three armies they see out on the horizon. Two of them, for some inexplicable human reason, somehow go after the third army that's supposed to be on their team. And they have this all-out war, and they annihilate Mount Seir, country number three. After they finish slaughtering the men from Seir, they help to destroy one another. The next thing that happens is, as the army is up on the hills watching, Ammon and Moab, nation one and two, go at it together. And by the time it's done, notice how the writer describes this. "When the men of Judah came to the place that overlooks the desert and looked toward the vast army, they saw only dead bodies lying on the ground. No one had escaped." Now, what would this say to a people who were up against the proverbial wall? I think there's one message. It would be this: don't despair. Do not give in to despair. Center your life on God. You are up against the wall, and only God can help you through this. On the back of your handout, king number three is Joash. He came in again after a time of decline in the temple, or in the nation, and repaired the temple. Verse 2. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years of Jehoiada the priest. Now, this guy had an advantage very few people have, and that is he had a tremendous mentor, Jehoiada the priest. And as long as Jehoiada lived, Joash did well. And as soon as Jehoiada died, he died at an old age, Joash started to go into a long tailspin in his relationship with God and his relationship with people. His heart began to harden as he turned the center of his life away from God and more towards trying to get life to be like it ought to be, and God ought to cooperate, and sort of all the quick fixes that made total sense to him. And one of the effects was it slowly hardened his heart. Verse 18. The people abandoned the temple of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and worshipped Asherah poles and idols. Because of their guilt, God's anger came upon Judah and Jerusalem. All these things made sense to them, and yet all it did was it prompted God to have to take more severe measures to deal with the people. He made everybody else's life harder because of what seems to make sense to him. Hezekiah also comes in after a time of national decline. Chapter 29. In the first month of his reign, he opened the doors of the temple of the Lord and repaired them. First thing, boom. We got to center life around God, and the picture of that is the temple life then. First thing, first month, first year, we're about repairing this thing. And he says, our fathers were unfaithful. They did evil in the eyes of the Lord, our God, and forsook him. They turned their faces away from the Lord's dwelling place and turned their backs on him. So what they're doing, the people before us, turned their backs on God. What we're going to do is we're going to center on him. This was an important word to the remnant. We're not going to do what those guys did. Remember, don't do that. Rebuild the temple. Rebuild the city. Verse 7, chapter 30. Do not be like your fathers and brothers who were unfaithful to the Lord, the God of their fathers, so that he made them an object of horror, as you see. They went through a time of terrible decline, and all the nations around said, I thought those were God's people. Look what he allowed to happen to those folks. How come? And even the pagans said, because they turned their backs on God. Now, that would be an important message to the remnant. We are not going to do what our forefathers did. We do not want to become an object of horror like we are now as a result of our fathers. This can be turned around. Do not be stiff-necked as your fathers were. Submit to the Lord. Come to the sanctuary, which he has consecrated forever. Serve the Lord your God so that his fierce anger will turn away from you. If you return to the Lord, then your brothers and your children will be shown compassion by their captors and will come back to this land. For the Lord your God is gracious and compassionate. He will turn his face from you if you return to him. Now, what Hezekiah said to the people, if we repent, if the nation turns around now, even though our nation's been on a moral decline for a number of centuries now, and it looks like judgment is imminent, which it was. Notice what he says here. There's coming a time when a nation is going to come and take us off. But if we will turn to God, then God will bring us back to here, back to our land. He will be kind and gracious to us. He will not turn his face from you if you return to him. That's exactly what happened. The people that read that must have gone, hey, that's us. God did exactly as Hezekiah said. He brought us back here after being in captivity all these years. That must have been electric to those people. Verse 21. It's a great summary verse of Hezekiah. In everything he undertook in the service of the house of God, and in accordance with the law and the command, seeking his God, he did with all his heart and prospered. He was centered. It's a message for the remnant. Be centered. The last king near the end is Josiah. There are a few after him that really take the nation down into a spiral, but he's the last good king. And he led the people in the greatest Passover in the history of the nation. The nation had just endured 50 years of King Manasseh, the worst king in the entire line of Judah. And there was a tremendous amount of reform that needed to happen. The temple needed to be cleared out of all these foreign gods, these detestable things, which he did. And as the priests were cleaning this thing out, they discovered a book. We would call it scrolls, which for an entire generation had been lost to the people, the Old Testament scrolls. And Josiah says, have the priest read these publicly. And as he's reading the covenant, he is mortified because he realizes we have sinned greatly against God. We have moved our whole nation in this direction. And it's just a matter of time before the hammer comes down on us, which we deserve. Verse 21, go and inquire of the Lord for me and for the remnant in Israel and Judah about what is written in this book that has been found. And he says, great is the Lord's anger that is poured out on us because our fathers have not kept the word of the Lord. They have not acted in accordance with all that is written in this book. Josiah got after it pretty hard here with the people, and they joined him, and they had a time, the last great time of reform and celebration in the land, and they celebrated the greatest Passover ever. Now, as we think about, as we close here, there may be something in your life where you are completely confused, you're in a tremendous amount of pain, you've done what made sense to you, and maybe now you're having some questions about that. Is God really big enough that he can use even my stupid decisions that made sense to me, but where I was determined to make my life work, and where it seems like I have unloosed hell on earth in me and in some people? Can God even take something of this mess that I've made? I see today, I see I've done this. Can he do something even with this? And the book of 2 Chronicles is a resounding yes. If you will center your heart on him, then he can rebuild out of rubble and when your back is against the wall. Let's pray together. Father, there are situations in our life that we sure wish we didn't have to go through. And we call out to you, as the people did long ago. And we want to move away from what makes sense to us, to make our life work as our highest priority, and to go 180 degrees and say, I belong to you because of Jesus Christ and what he did for me. And today, as I live my life, I want to relate to you well and respond to you what you have to say to me. And I want to reflect that love that you have for me in spite of me being a royal screw-up. I want to reflect that love that you have for me into the world of people today, into my relationships and my responsibilities. I want to honor you in what I'm doing today. That is a very different way to live. God, we thank you that you can do that. You can rebuild our lives when we put our center as you.